Blue Oyster Cult from 1976, Don't Fear the Reaper. I know what you're thinking. Why don't we have more cowbell in that song? It's an old joke. If you haven't heard it, then you have no idea what I'm talking about. Blue Oyster Cult, of course, in that song saying it's foolish to fear death. Jeff Kripal, my guest, is hard to pin down what his beliefs, his personal beliefs might be, but maybe we can get him to address the question of, does consciousness exist outside the body? Is something in us eternal? Does it live on even after we die? We'll try to get to that and talk about trickster phenomena right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Before the break, Jeffrey Kripal mentioned that he begins his chapter 8, his pivotal chapter, with talking about a guy named George Hansen, who, Jeff, I was surprised that you described him as a professional skeptic, because the parts that you include in this book sure don't sound like the typical skeptic that I encounter. This guy Hansen, as you say, he writes about, hey, if you're looking for evidence of, I don't know if I'm using this in air quotes, paranormal or supernatural, there's lots of evidence, but it sort of defies study, defies categorization or institutionalization. Tell us what you mean.
Well, it's what George means. I mean, George is an extremely sophisticated writer on the paranormal. He's a professional magician and a skeptic and a parapsychologist. He wrote this book called The Trickster and the Paranormal, which is one of the few books written by a parapsychologist that really understands the study of religion and the anthropology of religion. And so I really like it. And basically, George's argument, as I understand it, is that every culture has gaps or fractures in its system. In other words, there's no complete or perfect culture. There's no culture or worldview that can really explain everything about the world. Every worldview is unstable. It has these gaps in it. And for George, what the paranormal is the appearance of these gaps or these fractures in the Western worldview. It's essentially our dirt or our impurity. And I think that's actually really, really insightful. And of course, it's why, for example, materialistic scientists and debunkers react so strongly to paranormal phenomena, because these are essentially signs that our worldview is not complete or perfect. And this is also why it's so hard to institutionalize something like parapsychology or the study of the paranormal, because by its very nature, it's anti-structure, it's anti-institution, it's liminal, it's trickster-like. And so anytime you try to institutionalize its study, like, say, MUFON or professional parapsychology, you can do that a little, but it'll be very hard to get that institutionalized, say, like the study of chemistry or the study of philosophy or something that's, you know, been in the universities for centuries. And so as a result, we have really almost no departments of parapsychology in the U.S. We have a few working parapsychologists in universities, but no department of parapsychology.
Well, when I read this stuff, I thought immediately of Hunt for the Skinwalker, our story about this Utah ranch, which defies study, as you mentioned before the break. It defies study in so many strange ways. I mean, whatever this consciousness or intelligence is, it would avoid detection. It would pop up in very, very direct and challenging ways, physical ways, but it always stayed one step ahead of the investigators. I mean, it seemed like it could read their minds. They put a camera one place where things had happened, it'd appear somewhere else. And then at the end, as we tell the story, it reacted what you'd call angrily to pursuit by these scientists who were trying to get to the bottom of these various mysteries. It destroyed their camera and equipment in a very dramatic and violent way. And, you know, it sort of encapsulates the whole trickster thing in a nutshell for me. And I guess as an example that you've used as well.
Right. And the other thing, though, that's interesting to me about the Skinwalker case is, yes, you see all these trickster elements. On the other hand, whatever that thing or those things were, they clearly were drawing moral distinctions, right? I mean, they would, you know, turn a dog into goo or mutilate a cow, but they weren't mutilating human beings. So they seem to draw a line between animals and human beings, and, you know, they might have destroyed your equipment, but again, they didn't destroy you. So, yeah, they're trickster-like, they're liminal, they're not going to be turned into an object to study. On the other hand, they're not just chaotic, right? They're not just evil. It's something else. It's something in between. And George, this goes back, you know, early on in the textbook, I discussed this key expression, the sacred, which scholars of religion use all the time. And it's really important here when we're talking about the paranormal, because one of the basic mistakes people make about religion is they think that every religious experience, every instance of the holy is the same thing as the good. And historically, that is absolutely false. The sacred is better thought of as a kind of power or presence in the environment that interacts with individuals or communities in extremely destabilizing ways. And human beings can react to that presence either with fear and terror or with awe and love and affection. It can go either way. The sacred can be very positive or very negative. And this, of course, is exactly what we see in modern paranormal phenomena. We see things like the skinwalker, but we also see things like people encountering UFOs as sacred objects, as, you know, things of beauty and awe and mystery. And I think that this older view of the sacred, I think, really helps us understand the paranormal as a modern form of the sacred without falling into this simplistic trap of seeing it as just good or just evil.
You know, I joked before the break about I'd like an explanation for what happens to my socks, and it seems trivial, but, you know, in looking at the things that happened at that ranch, a lot of the things that occurred, and the ones that raise the hair on my arm more than the vaporizing the dogs, were the little things, the frying pan that gets moved into the freezer, or, you know, the mom would go into her bathroom and take a shower, she'd put her hairbrush and a towel on the counter, and she'd get out. The door is still locked, and these things are gone. You know, those kind of things, impish almost, but
right.
They happen.
Right, and again, they're interesting because they're not harming anyone, but they're clearly scaring people. They're clearly playing. They're clearly messing with us, they say.
You know, the skeptics, as you note in this chapter, the skeptics, they want paranormal stuff to play by the rules. Look, we want to have it in the lab. We want to measure it in the lab. We want to replicate it in the lab. And if it doesn't happen in the lab, then it's not real.
Right. And that's silly. I mean, that's my point. The argument there is the skeptics want it everything to play by their rules, and if it doesn't play by their rules, it doesn't exist. So the example I give, this is like, you know, going to the North Pole to prove the existence of zebras. You're not going to find zebras on the North Pole, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. It means you've created a set of conditions in which a zebra cannot possibly appear. And, you know, this is actually what the laboratory does, is it sets up a series of very rigorous conditions that basically make paranormal phenomena go away. And so it's very hard to get things to appear in a laboratory. It's possible, but it's going to appear in a very minor and fairly invisible way. You know, it's going to appear statistically. It's not going to jump out at you. And the other point, you know, I make in Chapter 8, but really throughout the textbook as well, is one of the real spikes of paranormal phenomena is around trauma. It appears that some kind of entropy, in this case emotional entropy, is necessary for these things to break into our world. And so people tend to have near-death experiences. They tend to see apparitions of loved ones around great physical suffering and the breakdown of the human body and brain. And again, you're not going to get those things in a laboratory, at least an ethical laboratory. They're just not going to appear.
You know, there's Uri Geller is a famous case. We've had Uri on the program. And of course, you know, a lot of the folks that he worked with at Stanford Research Institute, they were able to actually confirm and establish and replicate some of his abilities in a lab at SRI. But yet, you know, when Uri went on The Tonight Show, which it was sort of a, they set a trap kind of for him. It was a hostile environment for him, and he fell on his face, wasn't able to do the kinds of things that he had done in a lab and elsewhere. Well, people concluded, well, see, we cut off his ability to perform little magic tricks and to manipulate the arena, so to speak. So he has no abilities. You're familiar with that one?
Yeah, sure. And again, I think that's naive. I suspect. I mean, I don't know the Uri Geller case as well as other people know it, but my guess is that, you know, some of his stuff probably was essentially magic tricks, and some of it was no doubt real. And it was all mixed together. And of course, that's what we see in religion again. You know, that's what the shaman is. The shaman is this traditional psychic, basically, who learns a set of tricks that sometimes have very real effects. And so there's always this mixture of what I call fraud and fact or trick and truth that really can't be disentangled. And the example I give in the textbook is the placebo effect. A placebo is basically a fraud. It's a trick, but it works. and I think that's how, you know, religion works a lot. It's essentially a trick that works.
And nocebo, the nocebo works too. Didn't you say that in the book?
Yeah. The nocebo is, you know, when you essentially a curse or you give something to someone to tell them it's going to harm them, and it does. So, I think this is really important. I think this clear distinction between fraud and fact, or trick and truth, that the debunking community wants to make is simply, again, an ignorance of what the phenomena really are. And as a scholar of religion, I mean, we're constantly dealing with this mixture of trick and truth, and so we're very familiar with it.
You know, one concern that I guess people have is that mainstream science is so hostile to reports from regular people from around the world and throughout the centuries of extraordinary experiences they've had, encounters with something unknown, things that manifest themselves into our physical reality. Scientists tell people that never happened. You're wrong. It wasn't real. It's imaginary. It's in your head. You're completely wrong. It would seem to me to eventually that wears down public trust in science itself, which can't be good. I mean, they do a lot of good work.
Well, happily, not all scientists do that. The really good scientists won't do that. But unfortunately, some of them do exactly that. And I think that the most damaging social effect, there's two really damaging social effects, which I don't think they recognize all the time. One is that we create this culture of shame and humiliation. And so people go underground with their experiences. They shut up. They won't talk about it, even to their closest friends and families. And there's a kind of repression that takes place. But the other long-term effect that, you know, they don't think about at all is, this is, I think, fundamentalism actually is a response to this scientific dismissal of this aspect of human nature. It's the opposite, you know. There's something really similar about materialism and fundamentalism. They're completely opposite, but yet they're responding to one another. And I think if we could create a science that was sympathetic and took these things seriously, and then create a public culture around that, we would see that a lot of these fundamentalist movements would just, you know, lose their plausibility and become unnecessary.
There are several really great stories, captivating stories that you use to make points in the book. We have this poll running now on the Coast website about alien abductions, and I'm hoping people, our listeners, will respond to that, give us their input on it. But you have three stories right in a row about these unusual encounters. I won't call them alien abduction stories, but they come close to it. One involves a Nobel Prize winner. A second one involves a famous writer that we know on this program very well. And the third is you. I want to tell those stories. Let's start with the Nobel Prize guy to begin with.
Well, yeah, it actually probably makes more sense to start with Whitley, right? Because the Nobel Prize scientist is responding to Whitley.
Okay.
So Whitley Strieber, of course, your listeners know about, and so at the end of chapter three, I compare these three events. One is the visitor experiences of Whitley Strieber as communicated in communion, which I'm going to assume your listeners know about.
Sure.
And then the second one is Terry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for figuring out how to something called the polymerase chain reaction, which helped us figure out the human DNA, the Human Genome Project. Mullis was working, I believe, at Berkeley, and he drove up to his mountain cabin north of San Francisco one night, got there about midnight, was tired, had to pee, basically. And so he was walking out to his outhouse in this forest cabin and ran into a glowing raccoon. And he shone his flashlight on this thing. It wasn't glowing because his flashlight, it was literally glowing. And then the raccoon said to him, good evening, Dr. Mullis. And that was the last thing he remembered. And then 6 hours later, he was walking up to his cabin, you know, all disheveled and confused. And what's interesting about the Mullis case is when Strieber's communion came out, Mullis recognized his own experience in it instantly. And then his daughter, who had a similar experience at the same cabin, recognized her experience in Whitley's book. And so when Mullis goes to write his autobiography called Dancing Naked in the Minefield, he has a whole chapter on this event called No Aliens Allowed, and he's very explicit about it. You know, that this thing happened, and he doesn't know what it was about, but it really happened, and here it is. So you have the Strieber case, and then you have this scientist basically saying that, you know, something like that happened to him. And then the third case was happened to me, actually, in 1989 in Calcutta when I was working on my dissertation there. And I was engaged at something called Kali Puja, which is this festival at the end of October, early November, dedicated to the goddess Kali. During the night, I woke up, but my body didn't. I was essentially paralyzed in a kind of classic sleep paralysis case. And while I was trying to figure out what had happened, this energy came into the room or came out of me or came out of somewhere. I didn't know how. And it started to engage me in very dramatic, very erotic ways, but also very scary ways. My first assumption was that I was having a heart attack because it was centered in the heart region. And then I thought I was being electrocuted because it was extremely powerful energy. And then it just sort of imploded, and it resulted in a kind of classic out-of-body experience that abductees report. And so I look at those three experiences, and they're all very different. I mean, I didn't see any aliens. I didn't see any UFO. But a lot of the features of my experience can be found in the alien abduction feature. And so I just try to point out what's similar about those three cases and what's different.
What do you think? Did you invite that in?
I absolutely think I invited that in. I mean, I was completely absorbed in the rituals around Kali and the that whole tantric culture in West Bengal. And, you know, I was very much seeking that. So I absolutely invited that in. But I didn't create that or construct it. I mean, it behaved in ways that I found very confusing and didn't fit certain models in Bengali culture, but didn't fit other aspects. So it had its own life. It was its own thing. But yeah, I think I definitely invite that.
We're talking about spiritual, paranormal, supernatural, call them what you will, experiences with Jeffrey Krepel. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Norman Greenbaum takes us into the break. As you probably know, a personal tragedy, something in Eric Clapton's family, the loss of a loved one, inspired him to write this very moving song. And he asks the pertinent question whether he will know that person in the next life, assuming there is a heaven or something like it. And that kind of goes to the heart of all of the big questions, whether we go on from here. And we look to religion for answers to that. Some of us look to science. Jeff Krepel is sort of bridging the gap between the two and navigating between those two worlds, looking for answers to some of the biggest questions. When we come back, a couple of other stirring stories from his new book, Comparing Religion, Comparing Religions, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff, I want to follow up a little bit on the three-headed tale that you just told us. You told us about your experience, sort of an odd out-of-body kind of experience that you invited. Has it happened to you again? Have you tried to reenact it?
I've tried my whole life and have failed miserably. So, no. But, you know, it stuck with me, George. One of the results of it was when I came back into the body and woke up and got control of my body, I felt like these energies had been somehow, you know, embedded in me or, as we'd say later, downloaded. So it's really out of that experience that I write these books and try to understand other people's strange experiences. That experience made me very sympathetic to other people's experiences and made me realize that, you know, what they were reporting was real, even if it might be framed in different cultural terms.
So maybe you only needed one.
I think so. Who knows? I mean, I certainly wanted more than one, but it only takes one to change a person's worldview. I think that is true, actually.
Carrie Mullis, you told us about the story about the Nobel Prize winner who encountered this glowing raccoon and then sort of lost some time there. I think it's really brave of the guy to tell the world that it happened. I mean, he opens him up to a whole lot of ridicule. Do you happen to know how he's processed the reaction to it, how it's gone? I mean,
I don't know that, George. I would be really interested to find out. I mean, you know, once you win a Nobel Prize, in some ways you're immune to to things, but in other ways, of course, you're not. And my guess is he's taken a lot of heat for that. But it's a very brave chapter, and I thought it was done just right, actually.
And, of course, for Whitley Strieber, we've talked to him many times about his experiences and encounters. The book, the initial book, had that striking alien face on it. And, of course, people have figured out that's extraterrestrial. It's sort of become the face of the alien abduction phenomena.
Right.
But Whitley, as you note, he's gone a lot far, far beyond the idea that these are ETs from another planet. It's become a lot more exotic, his explanation. I don't think he's really got a complete handle on it yet, or maybe never will.
No, I don't think he does. I know Whitley quite well, and I've actually just wrote a whole essay on communion for an academic journal. And, you know, the more I engage Whitley's work, the more I realize how sophisticated it is. And I would agree with you completely. I think he resists any easy answer, I think. And he thinks that's partly the point of these experiences, is to sit with the question, not fall into the temptation to answer it as, you know, it's just the brain misfiring, or it's an ancient astronaut or an extraterrestrial. Neither one of those options are very convincing.
You had two other stories, not in this chapter, in an earlier chapter, The Flying Saint and The Levitating Medium. The Flying Saint being a guy known widely as Padre Giuseppe, but I guess became known as Saint Joseph. And you say that his case is really well documented. Over the break, I had a couple of listeners write to me and say, well, aren't there some Uri Geller is a fake, he's a fraud, he's a trickster, but aren't there cases of monks or holy people who've demonstrated paranormal abilities And you use the example of this Padre Giuseppe. Tell us the story.
Right. Well, again, I don't think Uri Geller was a fake.
I don't either.
I think he was a combination. You know, I think he was a trickster figure. It was a real deal, though. Yeah, the cases you're talking about, one is, let's call him Joseph of Cupertino. That's how he's known in the Catholic world. He's Saint Joseph of Cupertino. He's he's actually the patron saint of helicopter pilots, among other things. Joseph was, his life is extremely well documented, because what's unique about Catholicism is that they literally put their saints on trial. To become a saint, you have to go through this legal process, and lawyers are actually assigned, and the one lawyer that's assigned, which we know is the devil's advocate, is his whole purpose is to shoot the case down. So you need real proof to become a saint, and you need real proof of miracles, which are necessary but not sufficient. And in Joseph's case, he was a levitator. He would float off the ground or fly up to a tree and get stuck, by the way, couldn't get down. So there's a lot of humor in his life, too. And the church was, was actually concerned about Joseph for much of his life because he attracted such crowds. Everybody wanted to see and touch him. So they basically moved him church to church for most of his life to hide him from people, because he was always doing embarrassing things like flying up to trees or flying to churches. And that's very well documented. Even by a number of people, the politicians at the time, by churchmen at the time, by ordinary people at the time. And then the other case I show there is Daniel Douglas Hume, who was this super medium, Scottish super medium of the 19th century. And the point of that, who also levitated, by the way, under numerous circumstances, and who was never proven to be fraudulent. As well. And what the point of that comparison is that both men levitated before lots of individuals, but the cultures in which they lived came to completely different conclusions about them. So in Joseph's case, he became a Catholic saint, and it was framed as a miracle. In Daniel's case, he lived in 19th century Europe and the U.S. for a bit, and he was a medium, and was considered a fraud by skeptics and the real deal by people who were interested in mediums. But their levitation meant entirely different things in those two situations. Joseph, by the way, was an Italian Franciscan monk.
His levitation was part of the reason he became a saint?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
Absolutely.
And this guy, Daniel Douglas Hume, you write in the book that he had a lot of pretty famous people who were adherents or followers.
Oh, yeah. He was a superstar of his time. He was the Uri Geller of his time, and probably even more famous than Uri for there was no television, of course, but he was a big, big deal.
Napoleon? Mark Twain again?
Yeah, Mark Twain, a number of literary figures in England who were either attracted to him or horrified by him. These are two individuals with very eccentric lives. And there's a kind of humor in the stories, too, which I hope comes out in the book.
You had written earlier works about being, spending a lot of time on the ground and in the Asian subcontinent, and I don't know how extensive the rest of your travels were, but a lot of holy men over there, a lot of tricksters, snake charmers, things of that sort. You ever encounter monks or holy men whose abilities, who demonstrated something that, wow, you're thinking, how did they do that?
I encountered a lot of sadhus or holy men when I lived in India, but I didn't see any magicians or any tricksters. I wasn't looking for that. I suppose if I would have been looking for that and took the time and trouble, I could have done that. But no, I didn't.
I don't remember where this is in the book, but I remember the story, the imagery stuck in my head. It's about a colleague of yours, a good friend of yours that has been an inspiration to you. I think he was studying Esalen and along those lines, and he had sort of an epiphany moment where I can't remember the phrase, but you were talking about looking at the lookers, looking back, something of that sort. You know,
That was Eric Davis. Eric's a well-known writer in these worlds. Lives in California, actually doing a PhD at Rice University with us at the moment, writing his dissertation. But he was actually in a Buddhist retreat north of San Francisco, and had this, you know, this sort of profound moment where he sort of separated from his body and his ego and sort of observing himself, and he sort of goes up this metaphysical ladder, as it were, until he has this realization that consciousness is not the ego, it's not the body, it's something else.
Is that the only time he did that? Or something like it?
Eric has had lots of experiences like that. Eric, by the way, is someone you should have on the show. He's written many books, including a book called Nomad Codes, in which he discusses a lot of these experiences. And he also wrote a book called Technosis, which was on the interface between technology and mysticism and magic. So he's well versed in these areas.
You mentioned Terence McKenna, Dennis McKenna, their exploration of psychedelic, sort of psychotropic plants as a way to sort of reach the eternal or communicate with something else or travel through dimensions, or we're not quite sure exactly how it works, but what do you think of that as a method for accessing the big picture?
Well, yeah, I discussed that in the chapter on nature and religion. And one of the things I point out is that human beings have been ingesting sacred plants or psychotropic plants for millennia, as far back as we can see in the historical record. And there's something about the plant world and the human world that, of course, are very much, we evolve together. And the way sacred plants work is they interact with our brain chemistry and help us to have these sorts of experiences. And I happen to think, in many cases, those are perfectly genuine religious experiences. I follow Aldous Huxley here, who pointed out that these things may not be caused by the plants, but the plants might have some effect on the brain that lets these sorts of experiences in. And that's a subtle distinction, but it's an important one.
Didn't you say something to the effect of it eliminates the filters that keep us from seeing this stuff, something like that?
Right, that's Huxley's point. It's what we call the filter thesis, which is really important to the whole book. There's two basic models of consciousness or the mind-brain relationship. One is what we call the productive model, and that's the standard materialist or scientific model. And that says that consciousness is created in toto by brain. That consciousness is a process created by material things happening in the brain. Then there's something we call the filter thesis, which says that consciousness actually exists outside the body and brain and is filtered or mediated by brain and body to create this movie we call an ego or a person. But consciousness itself is not actually in the brain. And the filter thesis works really well with the psychedelic context, because what Huxley argued was that what something like mescaline does, it doesn't create these experiences by messing with brain chemistry. It actually traumatizes the brain and shuts it down or shuts aspects of it down rarely, so these other forms of mind can come rushing in. And I think that makes a lot of sense, particularly because we see other forms of religious experience in traumatic moments like car accidents, heart attacks, strokes, things like that.
You know, I've read about people taking mushrooms, LSD, and the different kinds of long-lasting effects they say it has, in that it sort of is like taking sandpaper to the sharp edges, rounding things down a little bit. There is at least some clinical evidence, recent clinical evidence about long range or permanent effects of these plants. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am. You know, The psychedelic question is a really poignant one, and it really depends on who you talk to. Of course, a lot of these substances can have devastating social and personal effects as well, through addiction, things like that. But on the other hand, people do have these transformative religious experiences on them as well. And I think both things are probably true. But again, I think this is another example of how human beings have always sought out these altered states of consciousness, energy, and the sacred is something that can transform us positively or destroy us. So I think there's that both and again there with this particular question.
You make the point in the book too that it's not necessarily rebels or hippies or outsiders who try this stuff, who try to use plants or substances to communicate with the sacred or the holy. It's the intellectuals of their time.
Right. I mean, the way psychedelics got into American culture was through the medical establishment, the universities, and particularly through a banker of all things. Gordon Wasson. So these things did not originate in that counterculture. They originated in the university scientific community, and then they seeped in, actually, to the culture through this. And if you read somebody like Aldous Huxley, I mean, this is what he thought. I mean, what Huxley thought was that these things are incredibly powerful. They're actually too powerful, and that they should be carefully controlled and only taken under very special circumstances. And he was actually really upset with his friend Tim Leary, who thought everybody should be doing this. release it into the water supply, as it were. And Huxley just thought that was crazy and was going to get them into a lot of legal trouble. And, of course, he was right about that.
You said a couple of minutes ago how, sometimes the pursuit of the sacred, I don't want to misquote you, can be used to destroy. One of the points you made at a point in the book is about how religions will use these kinds of things to bash other religions, Protestants singling out Catholics, aha, all these ceremonies and stuff. It's like, I don't want to say like witchcraft, but it seems like you're pursuing magic. It's a reason not to be Catholics. They can use it as a wedge issue.
Right. So there's two issues in what you just said, George. One of my arguments is that the experience of the sacred itself can be destructive. If you look in the Bible, there's this notion that if you actually encounter God, you will die. God isn't some kitten or fuzzy, warm creature in a lot of the Bible. He's this awesome energetic presence that if you get too close will kill you. So the sacred itself is a lot like, the imagery I use in the book is the sacred is like a nuclear power plant. A temple is a nuclear power plant. And the culture wants to use the energy of the sacred, but you don't want to get too close to it. And so you got to wrap it around with rituals and priesthoods, buildings, and protect yourself from it. So that's the one level. The other level, which you just mentioned, is again a lot of communities' comparative practices are destructive and dangerous. Religions tend to make absolute truth claims and want to therefore reject other religions and other religious communities as not part of the truth of things. That's a comparative practice, right? We have the truth, you don't. Therefore, we are the really genuine religious people, and you people over there are fakes or whatever the language is. And that's a comparative practice, and it's a dangerous one. And so what the book is trying to do is wake people up to their comparative practices and help them do that a lot better.
When you use the phrase about the nuclear power plant, I was thinking to myself, the image that came to mind was Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant.
Right, right. And of course, that's a Hollywood movie, but it's actually based on biblical texts in which you really can't touch the Ark. I mean, I actually discuss the Ark of the Covenant in the textbook, and when I'm talking about the sacred, and I just quote this scene in which, you know, they're carrying the ark and this priest just slips, basically, and accidentally touches it and he's killed instantly.
Well, we'll pick up that conversation on the other side, and maybe I can pin you down on a couple of spiritual questions. The Beach Boys, God Only Knows, take us into the break, and we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions for my guest, Jeff Kripal, right after this.